So thank God we get to gather again this year, preparing for Pesach with some ideas to share at the Seder. We need to prepare ourselves for Pesach always, not just physically, but also spiritually. Sometimes that's a good respite from the Avodas Farech. I want to dedicate tonight's learning Le'ili Nishmas, two people who are near and dear to our family, to our two grandparents who we lost this week, my grandmother, Aleha Shalom, Esther Bas Rav Eliyahu, and Nechama's grandfather, Rafael Ben Arav Ephraim, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, who passed away this morning. And I remember as a child, we would drive in the station wagon late Thursday night when my father would come home from work. We would, after dinner, usually in our station wagon, there was the back, which would lay flat, and in those days, nobody said it was a problem to sleep in sleeping bags. So we had sleeping bags like little Franks and Blanks in the back lined up, and we would drive to Far Rockaway, and my parents lived on 809 Empire, my grandparents. We'd pull in, and we'd come through the back door of my grandparents' home, Zichronam Levracha. My grandmother's kitchen was absolutely spotless. The only thing that was on the counter, which would never move, was the KitchenAid. That KitchenAid had like hundreds of thousands and millions of frequent flyer turns on that KitchenAid. And we would come to Far Rockaway, and down Empire Avenue was the White Shul, where my grandparents davened, and where Rabbi Polkovitz was the rabbi, and then later the rabbi emeritus for over 65 years. 65 years in the same community, in the same shul. And I remember going there as a child. We learned how to daven. There was a gabbai, like a youth minion fellow. His name was Mr. Schlossel, Olav Shalom. So we had junior congregation, and that was a big part of my childhood. So when Nechama and I got married, it was kind of like this strange confluence of my youth. I did tell Rabbi Polkovitz, Zichrono Levracha, I told him, you know, one of the things that we absolutely hated as kids, the worst thing ever, was when we would come to Far Rockaway and the Balabatim would bring, and this happened on occasion, they would bring chazanim from Europe. You know, eight-year-old kids, they have to sit in shul and wait till like 4 p.m. when the Balabatim were finished davening. It was mamish torturous. But they were both the matriarch of our family, my grandmother and Rabbi Polkovitz, of course, the rabbi's rabbi, the end of an era in many respects in that community, and they had such a huge impact. So our teaching in our Masorah is just a continuation of those things that they taught us. Some of you know that my grandmother's family, the Fink family from Scranton, was featured on the front page of Life magazine in 1955 because they were looking for a family of three generations of Orthodox Jews outside of the New York area. So they came to my grandmother's family, the Finks, where they had a farm not far from Scranton in Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. And my grandmother could tell you many, many stories, but she met my grandfather through a shidduch because she would deliver Chol of Yisrael milk and cheese from the farm by train to Rebbe's in Williamsburg. And the Kafishnitz Rebbe knew that my great-grandfather was a Rav and he had a son who worked, so they were set up. And they found out about this family, three generations of Orthodox Jews. So they came, and there was a picture in Life magazine, on the front cover, one picture, and this was given to me by someone here in the neighborhood who happened to be junking in Michigan somewhere, and he mentioned to me at a Shabbos meal, he said he saw Life magazine with a woman on the front cover benching licht, front page paper. He's like, I couldn't believe there was a Jewish picture. I said, yeah, that's my great aunt, Tavi, Allah Hashalom, from the farm. He said, really? Next week I get it in the mail. And inside, they actually have a picture of my great-grandfather and their family at a mock Seder table. Because they wanted to depict, what if you're going to think about how do you depict Orthodox Judaism, one key thing to depict is the Seder. And that obviously is an iconic image, and I could see that image of my mind of Pa Fink sitting at the Seder table on the farm. And then now I could see Rabbi Polkovitz, Zichrono Levracha, the last many years that we've had the privilege of being together with them on Pesach, sitting at the head of the Seder table with great-grandchildren. That's an important image. And those are people who are going to always remain with us, and our learning tonight should be Le'ili Nishmasam. So Stephen Covey famously teaches that you need to begin, Olav Shalom, you need to begin with the end in mind. And I wonder if this is why starting in the 15th century, in Ashkenazi Haggadahs, you start to find certain pizmonim, certain songs with which you end the Seder. In certain houses, by this time, people, it doesn't happen so much to me, because most of my cups, they're like 60% grape juice, and then the rest, 40%, whatever the lightest wine they have on the table is. So by the time I'm at Echad Miyodea, I can count, no problem. But there are some people for whom Echad Miyodea, getting from 1 to 13, by that time they're a little bit, I don't want to say they're getting silly, but they're starting to lose it a little bit. So you wonder, like, why did they put, at the end of this whole story, the whole Chag Gadya, the whole everything, they put these family children's songs of Echad Miyodea and Chag Gadya. And I wonder if the answer is exactly what Stephen Covey is trying to get at, which is, when we start the Seder, we need to begin with the end in mind. We need to know what the goal is. What do we want to get out of this? What is the function of the Seder? And once you understand the function, the form is going to follow that. It's always the form follows the function. Ultimately, all we need to know is that Echad Elokeinu, as Rabbi Pelkovitz used to say, Zichron Levracha, the Seder we used to sing, he had a Yiddish song, Un Gott is Einer, Un Mer is Keiner. That's what he used to say. Un Gott is Einer, there's only one God. And that's what we want our children and everyone at the Seder to know. So we end with that, because that's going to be our destination. And if at the end of the day, that's the one thing that we walk away with, then that's a success. Everything that's happening in the Seder is just to make that point. It's an experiential learning experience. It's a whole evening just to tell us one thing, that there is a God. I have a God in my life, a personal relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, and that is a singular connection. And maybe that's why. And so especially, I once heard a beautiful verse from Rabbi Fran, from Baltimore, especially with this idea of, you know, what do you associate with your numbers when you have people who are like a little bit tipsy by the end of the Seder? If you wake somebody up who comes from Baltimore, if you wake them up in the middle of the night at 4 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning and you say to them, what's number 8? It's not complicated. Everybody knows what number 8 is in Baltimore. What's number 8? That's right. Who said that? That's right. Cal Ripken! Number 8! Number 8! That's it. If you're, and as Rabbi Fran was saying, it's very strong. Even though he's not from Baltimore, he's adopted a shtick of a Baltimore accent. If you ask people from Baltimore, as they say, like from the old country, if you're from Baltimore, you know that number 8 is Cal Ripken. That's it.
23.
Okay, here is 23. You don't have a Shiloh. In Baltimore, I was going to say in America. In Baltimore, there's only one number 8. So what Rabbi Franz said is in his inimitable way, he said, when you get to the end of the Seder, by the time the person is so sedreit, when you ask them what is the number 8, they don't actually say Cal Ripken. They ask them what's the number 1, they say Echad Elokeinu v'Hashemayim v'Aretz. We've drilled down so far that it becomes part of our subconscious, that is our automatic association with the number 1. I once wrote an email to somebody, a member of the board of the Kollel, and on occasion I'll write board members these emails, what I'll call by the numbers, and I'll list off different stats that have been happening in the Kollel. 500 numbers of this, and 47 numbers of that, and 3 of this, and 1. And I once ended, many years ago, I once ended this email with number 1, the YU Tormit Zion Kollel. There's only one Kollel like that. And one board member wrote back to me, he said, that's really the number 1? I said, you're right. Since then, the number 1 is the Ribbono Shel Olam. Echad Elokeinu v'Hashemayim v'Aretz. Because at the end of the day, that's the goal. If we don't have that feeling, if we haven't drilled down that is the subconscious message that we are trying to get across and we have succeeded in getting across, then we haven't really done it. We're going to do a lot of things. We're going to throw frogs and we're going to play games and we're going to sing songs. But all of those are to get to the same point, that when we ask somebody, what is Echad? What is the final thing that you walk away from? The whole story of the Chag Gadya, you may have started here and you went there and the next thing, but the end is V'as HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There is a God in my life, and that's what we have to begin the Seder with. We have to know that that's our destination, so that everything that happens to this in the Seder gets to that point. That's number 1. Number 2 is that Yetzias Mitzrayim, the idea of being in Mitzrayim, in exile, is not just a historical one. And it's not just that every Seder night we have to relive that b'chol dor v'dor chayv adam lirusis atzmo. Many Chassidish Sfarim talk about the fact that in our lives, we sometimes go through periods of Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is similar to the word Mitzarim, Bein HaMitzarim, between the straits. And we find ourselves in a difficult place. And we have to know in our lives that there are periods of Mitzrayim, but then there are periods also of Yetzias Mitzrayim. So what we have at the Seder is a microcosm of this cycle, and we're going to need to take it away, take that message away from the Seder in general, so that we can draw upon it during the rest of the year. This is a book called Jewish Values in a Changing World. It's an English translation of Sichot of the late Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Etzion, Rav Yehuda Amital. It's translated by some of the Rabbanim in Gush. And in the end, in the last chapter, he has a section on dealing with crisis. And he quotes from the Helega Machne Ephraim, the Degel Machne Ephraim, which was Ramosha Chaim Ephraim, in the name of his grandfather, the Helega Baal Shem, who says that there's something called greatness and smallness. Sometimes a person is in a good spot. That's a moment of greatness. Maybe you could call it godless. And then there are times of katness, of smallness, when a person is in a descent. What we would say, the person is in Mitzrayim. They're trapped. They feel small. And he says that the descent is for the purpose of ascent, when one is constantly aware, knowing and feeling that he is in a state of smallness and praying in God. And then he quotes the pasuk Ubikashna Misham. This is from there, from the place in which a person is found. So it's impossible, says the Degel Machne Ephraim, to always be in one place. There are going to be good days, and then there are going to be challenging days. There are going to be days when we're going to be drinking Dalet Kos, and there are days when we're going to be struggling. And we need to know that so that we don't become despair when we're getting to the bottom of the down period. And so he quotes from Rav Kook a similar idea that he says, when a person feels totally empty inside, when he sees himself as amounting to naught, when his soul curls up inside, greatly depressed and sensing its own nullity, he should know that God's salvation will soon shine upon him, and that the measure of good is greater than the measure of punishment. And just as pride goes before the fall, loneliness in spirit and inner modesty precede greatness and light. And he writes a similar piece elsewhere. It says, when a person feels that he is in great spiritual ruin, he should know that the opportunity has arrived to erect a new building, one that is more lofty and elevated, more stable and magnificent than what had been there previously. He must fortify himself and gather strength to improve his ways and deeds with proper order. And I wonder if this is something that we take away from Yetzias Mitzrayim. Sometimes we don't know, as Laurel and Hardy once discussed, how we got into this fine mess. We don't know how that happened. Chazal struggled to figure out how we got down to Mitzrayim. Was it because of Avraham Avinu and something that he said? Was it because of Yosef? Something happened with the brothers? Was it some mystical? We don't exactly know. Vaharaya, they have to give multiple interpretations. If there was one reason, they just give it to you. It's a mystery. There are approaches, but we don't have one single answer that the Rebbe Shlom wrote down on a piece of paper and said, this is the reason for the Jewish exile in Egypt. So we don't know why sometimes we experience times of difficulty in our life. But what we do know is, Anochi eredim cha mitzrayma v'anochi alcha gamalo. I'll go down with you to that low place and I'll come back up with you. That the Rebbe Shlom is always with us through that journey, and that there are going to be those valleys, but then there are also going to be peaks. And we need to avoid being overwhelmed with despair when we find ourselves in those difficult places. We need to always draw on Yetzias Mitzrayim. We go through the night, we have 15 steps, and we call these steps the Seder. And this Seder kind of represents a totality of the experience. And how would you summarize, if you had to think of one word to summarize the totality of the experience, and I suspect if we went around this room, we would come up with a lot of different words to capture the summary of the experience. But I think one interesting word that captures the experience through the prism of the Seder is called spirituality. That may be the word. And that is the buzzword, that is the way that you capture it. In this Haggadah, it's called From Bondage to Freedom, the Passover Haggadah, with a commentary illuminating the liberation of the spirit by Rabbi Abraham J. Twersky, M.D. Dr. Tversky is very into spirituality. You could argue he's into spirituality more than he is into religion, but that is a separate observation. And he points out that so much of the Haggadah is an exploration of spirituality. He looks at it from his experience of many decades treating enslaved people, enslaved, Rahmanul Islan, to substance abuse and other addictions, whether it's alcohol and other kinds of things, gambling. So he saw people who are mishubad. They were mamish mishubad. And he talks about his whole worldview is shaped by this experience. And he talks about how looking at the Seder as a spiritual journey, he can't help but reflect on the patients that he's seen and the experiences that he's had as a psychiatrist. And the core that he comes back to in so many books that he writes is the core of spirituality. And how in many cases, the people who he's worked with and have been successful in becoming free from their own slavery, from their own servitude, to whatever it was that was chaining them down, has been spirituality. Not necessarily religion, but spirituality. And I wonder if you look at the Seder, and he talks about it from different aspects, but I was wondering if there really are two key ingredients to spirituality that you find in the Seder that you can draw upon in this frame of how to look at the Seder and leading a spiritual life. One aspect, and they're a little bit counterintuitive, but I think if you think about them carefully, you can see that they are harmonious. One is the idea of Seder, the idea of organization and prioritization and control and management. That is the meaning of the word Seder, that there is an order. You know, a person, Rahman al-Islan, who is subject to the outside influence that is controlling them, they don't have control over themselves. And what is the process of freeing themselves? It's taking control of their life. One of the things that Dr. Tversky talks about a lot is the 12-step program, you know, for Alcoholics Anonymous. So that is a Seder. Think about that. It's a 12-step process. Well, we have a 15-step process. It starts at Kaddish and ends. But the idea is you have to have a Seder. It's not haphazard. It can't be just random. You have to take control of your life and bring order to your life. You have to take control of yourself and make decisions that are bounded and grounded. And that's why there are rules. And we're going to set down those rules for ourselves based on what the Haggadah gives us. And therefore, it's not, you know what, we're going to make a Seder based on whenever we feel like sitting down and whatever we feel like drinking and whatever we feel like eating and whatever we want to have it. No. Here's the time. You don't make Kiddush until after Tzeis. According to many, you don't eat your Afikoman after Chatzos. You have to make sure that there isn't a Shemetz of any kind of Chametz anywhere in your house. And it's not like, you know, well, what's the big deal if I have one box of Oreos in the closet? What's the big deal if Rahman al-Islan, someone who's an alcoholic, has one drink? You know what? One drink for an alcoholic, that's a big deal. What's one drink? What's one shot? The answer is that to be free from that, you have to have total control over your life. Otherwise, God forbid. And he has amazing stories about people. I forget the exact number. In one of his companion to the Machzor, he has a description of a man who died, and he had a little pinkas, a notebook, where he kept tick marks, 44,000 tick marks, of days that he had been sober till the day he died. This person, I forget, like some insane number, because that was the self-control that he needed to free himself from before. So if we want to be spiritually free, if we want to control our lives, the restrictions and the guidelines of halacha, they are tools. They're not chains. Those are the tools to live a free spiritual life, because they enable us to take control of our life. So on the one hand, there's Seder. On the other hand, that Seder is punctuated by l'chaims. Pardon the mixed metaphor from the alcoholism. And if you know somebody who has an issue of alcoholism, tell them I will be happy to make them my special recipe of dalat kosos. There's no problem driving after I finish my dalat kosos. So let it not be confused. But there is a debate in halacha as to whether or not grape juice is acceptable for dalet kosos. Many poskim assume that grape juice alone is acceptable for dalet kosos, although you should be careful because if you use grape juice from concentrate, that might not be acceptable for dalet kosos because it's really water that was reconstituted. So many poskim have a question about grape juice for concentrate, so when you buy your grape juice, take a look. But what is the reason for many poskim who oppose the use of grape juice? Because they say if the whole point is to make a l'chaim, to celebrate, how many people do you know make a l'chaim on grape juice? So I can tell you, I would gladly make a l'chaim on grape juice. When we got engaged, so there was a l'chaim in my house, in my parents' house. So I went around, I had a little shot glass that I went around with, and I was making l'chaims with everybody. And because it was a kind of a light tea-colored, like a light brown-colored liquid, everybody thought that I was drinking with them. But it was iced tea. And anybody knows, they would not be surprised that was iced tea, because there was no way that's not my thing. And so I'm happy to make a l'chaim on grape juice, no problem. But for some people, that's not a l'chaim. Why is that important? Because the whole point is that you should celebrate. That's the point of the dalet kosos. It should be a l'chaim, it should be a celebration. So the fact that we paskin that it's kosher to use dalet kosos from grape juice, that's good. But it shouldn't take away from the fact that we're supposed to celebrate. A person who leads a true Torah spiritual life is supposed to celebrate. It's supposed to be geshmak. It's supposed to be awesome. It's supposed to be wonderful. It's not supposed to be depressing and onerous and horrible. If it is, then that's a problem. And that's not a stira to the Seder. You can have Seder, you can have discipline, and you could still have a great time. You could still celebrate. You could still create meaning. It doesn't necessarily mean that everything is fun. It's not necessarily that Yiddishkeit and spirituality are always fun or a high, but it's the happiness and the contentment. And if you're missing that, if you're missing that l'chaim, then you're missing the whole experience of Judaism and spirituality. Great mashal, some of you probably have heard before. Imagine an elderly person, they get off a plane at O'Hare and they have one of the bellboys from the, I don't remember what they're called, the service folks from the airline. They push them in the wheelchair, up the jetway, down the elevator, they're waiting at the bottom for the bag. And so here you have this elderly gentleman sitting in the wheelchair at the back by the chairs. They don't push them near that little snake conveyor belt because they could get trampled by the people. So they keep them at the back, you know, where their chairs, and unfortunately the people who are sleeping from their overnight layover that they couldn't make. So they're sitting there in the back and they have the porter, and they tell the porter, you know, I have one check bag. The porter says, I'll be happy to get your check bag. How would you describe it? They say, well, it's a rectangular black bag with wheels. Okay, great. So they say, okay. The porter says, I'm going to go over there to the belt and I'm going to pick it up and I'll bring it to you and you'll read the tag. You'll tell me if this is the right bag. So the porter goes over there to carousel number 9, and the elderly gentleman is sitting in the wheelchair far away. And the guy looks up and he's waiting, and finally he picks up a bag and he gives a krechts. He lifts up this huge suitcase and he turns around to bring it back to the gentleman to inquire if this is his suitcase. And the man just kind of waves him off. He says, no. He's 35 feet away, waves him off. 5 minutes later, the things are going around and around in the conveyor belt. Another big black suitcase comes out. He picks it up. He schleps it off. He turns around. And before he can make one move, the elderly gentleman says from the wheelchair, motions to him that it's not the right one. Finally, 3 minutes later, another suitcase comes off. He picks it up, pulls it off. It's a black rectangular suitcase. He brings it over to the man. The man says, let me look. He starts investigating the tag. It says his name. He says, this is the right one. Thank you very much. Now we can go to the curbside. So the porter says to the gentleman, he says, can you explain to me something, sir? I don't know how old you are, but I don't know if you can see very well, but I don't understand. How could you tell from your wheelchair spot that the suitcase that I picked up over there was not your suitcase? And the man said, simple. I know how heavy my suitcase is. I'm 86 years old. I know exactly how much I packed. When I saw you schlep that suitcase off the conveyor belt, I knew it's too heavy. It's not my suitcase. That was the dead giveaway. If you see somebody observing Yiddishkeit and they are so burdened, it's so heavy, they're so weighed down that their back is killing them from Yiddishkeit, you have to tell them they're picking up the wrong suitcase. They have the wrong Yiddishkeit. That's not Judaism. That's not our Yiddishkeit. Yiddishkeit, it has order. It has rules. You get to the gate at this time, and you get on the plane at this time, and if you don't get on the plane, they close the door, whether you like it or not. But at the same time, it's not just that there is only a Seder and orders and closing doors and opening doors. There's a sense of celebration. There's a sense of joy. And that's a big piece of the Seder. If a person doesn't walk away from the Seder smiling, so then there's something that's missing out. That doesn't mean that there aren't going to be things that are going to be disappointments. No Seder is perfect. Whether it's somebody forgot their this, or this got overdone, or they, you know, it's running late, and this one's agitated, and the old people are upset, and the young people are upset, and the middle people, they don't even know which one to be upset at. You know, that's okay. That's not the main thing. The main thing is, how do we feel about our Yiddishkeit? If our kids walk away and they see, oh, this is great, if the people walk away from the Seder and say, this is a celebration of spirituality, then the Seder has been a hit. And if it's not a celebration, then we need to rethink it. Then we need to go back to it. So it's both the spirituality of order, as Dr. Twersky would talk about, but also the spirituality of celebration. So let's get started. Avodim Hayinu. You know, we ask the question of the Manishtana, and we look for an answer. So maybe we get an answer. I always thought that we get an answer. The child asks four questions, and the parent says, don't worry, here's your answer. Avodim ayinu lefar b'mitzrayim vayotzienu. Or mitchila ovdi avodah zara hayoseinu v'achshav kembanu amakom. It's we start with the bad and we end with the good. So it's either we were slaves and then we were freed, or it's we were idol worshippers and then we got out. That's the way I always understood it. But the truth is, I'm not sure if that really is a great answer. In the following sense, aside from the fact that some observe that Manishtan is not actually a series of questions, it's a series of observations and declarations, but even so, I don't understand the answer. I never thought about it until they see her in this way. The child says, in a certain phrase, what he's saying is, I'm confused. You're telling me that tonight we're reclining because we're free, and now you're telling me we're also eating matzah because we were slaves? Well, no. The matzah is because we were free. So why are we eating maror? Because we were slaves? Which is it? Are we free or are we slaves? I'm pretty confused. So how do we answer this kid's confusion? So I wonder, and this is alluded to in this Haggadah by Dr. Twersky, and I think we can embellish this idea, I wonder if in a certain sense we don't exactly answer the child's question. And that's okay. Because the child says, you know, look, I live in a confusing world. I live in a world that has matzah that represents freedom and matzah that represents slavery. I live in a world where there's good and evil. I live in a world that there's chayrus and avdus, and I can't really make sense out of it. There's a lot of confusion. I have a lot of questions. There are people in this world, they should live and be well, but they're not as many as they used to be, who when they sit down to the Seder, their Seder and their story of avdus lechayrus, of going from the Meitzar, from literally Shibud Mitzrayim, is not theoretical, it is literal. And many of those people sit at the Seder and they ask the Manishtana, who's going to answer their Manishtana? Who's going to answer that question? So I wonder if the answer to the child is to say, you know what? It's okay in life. It's okay to live with unresolved questions. It's something that Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Levracha, talked about in Kol Dodi Dofeik. And it's something that Dr. Twersky says is very healthy psychologically. Because today, very often, people are looking for all the answers. Easy answers to all the questions. Let's answer all the questions. Let's put it to bed. Let's look at, as Rav Soloveitchik discusses in another essay, let's look for religion as the opioid to the masses, as the panacea, to say religion will solve all the questions. It'll answer all the questions. And Rav Soloveitchik says it doesn't work like that. Judaism doesn't answer all the questions. But you know what it does? It tells a story. It tells us a story that there is a God, and God created the world, and He took us out of Egypt, and He gave us the Torah, and He's been with us throughout that entire journey. So maybe that's the answer that we tell our children and that we tell ourselves. Avodim hayinu lefarah b'mitzrayim vayotzeinu. Why is it that there are so many complexities in this world? I don't know the answer to that. But what I do know is that there is a God, and He took us out once, and He took us out again, and He took us out again, and He has been there with us in the difficult times and in the easier times. Can I explain why those things happen? I can't really explain them. I can't really reconcile them for you. I can't tell you why there's Marah in this world and why there's leaning, why there's Haseh, but all I know is that the Ribbono Shel Olam made the world this way, and He is with us through the entire journey. So in a certain sense, Avodim Hayinu, you can view it not so much as a specific answer to say, this is why certain things happen, as much as saying, this is the way that we tell our story. And by telling that story, we can live with these questions. Rav Amital, we mentioned before, you know, his name was not originally Amital, his name was Klein. He came from a small Transylvanian community. He was sent to a labor camp, the rest of his family, you know what happened to them. So someone once asked him, you know, he was the Baal Tefillah, the Chazan for Yom Narayim in Gush. So someone once asked him, a newspaper man once asked him, they said to him, Rabbi, how do you do that? How do you stand before God on the high holy days and lead the whole yeshiva in a very powerful davening? He said, when it comes to the Shoah, he says, I have a wall. I stand before a wall, I have questions. But those questions do not preclude my having a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I live with questions, and that's okay. The fact that I live with questions doesn't take away from the fact that I celebrate a life of closeness with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That closeness is on Yom Narayim, and of course, that closeness is at the Seder. Number five. Vayehi Sham Lagoy, we became a nation. On Sunday afternoon, I had the incredible schus of a lifetime to sit in Rabbi Pelkovitz's room while he was lying there in his bed, and things were not very good. And he had this oxygen in his nose. It was not a great situation. So I sat next to his bed and I held his hand and I said, you know, Saba, on Wednesday night I'm going to give a shiur on the Haggadah. So he perked up. And I started to share with him some of the ideas that I was preparing for tonight that I'm sharing with you. And he said, after I had shared with him a few things, he said, I think you should talk about the individual and the community. And so I said, oh, that's an interesting idea. I wonder if that relates to the comment of Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch in the Hakdama to Sefer Devarim. See, Rav Hirsch is bothered with the question of many commentators as to why it is that Sefer Devarim is the way that it is Bechlal. It introduces new mitzvahs that didn't appear in the previous four books, and it recapitulates mitzvahs that we already had. So why is that? So Rav Hirsch has an amazing yisod. He says that, you know, there are two kinds of mitzvos, and there are two kinds of Judaism. There are the mitzvos that relate to the individual, and then there are the mitzvos that relate to the nation. Sometimes you can have the same mitzvah, but it takes on a totally different dimension when you think about it on a national plane. Shabbos is one thing that exists irrespective of where you are. You observe Shabbos in all four corners of the earth. But Shabbos, on a national level, has a whole different character. When I shared it with him, he nodded, he liked it, he thought it was good. And you could think about that idea in light of 70 years of Medinas Yisrael this year, that Medinas Yisrael doesn't just provide a hechatimtza, a mechanism for us to fulfill individual mitzvos. It brings us closer to the Geula in that it creates a whole new dimension of Judaism. Now it's not the fragmented Golus observance, which unfortunately we who are sitting here in Chicago now are observing. It's a paltry experience where it's just my little kosher food and my little Shabbos and my little Talmud Torah. But it's nothing compared to the dimension of what it means to have a state, to have a nation. Says the verse, that is why Sefer Devarim is there, because it's the story of the nation, of the community. And there's no such thing as a community outside of Israel. Israel is the community. That's the tzibah. That's the Gemara says in Horius and Daf Gimel. And so this is an idea that we see developing at the Seder. The Seder is the birth of the Jewish community, of the Jewish nation. Because we came down b'shivim nefesh, as 70 souls, but now, v'yihi sham l'goy, we became a nation. And what was the destination of that nation? It was to leave Egypt, pick up the Torah, and settle in Israel. So we need to remind ourselves, this year, the 70th year of the State of Israel, that we are looking at, in a certain respect, one aspect of Geulas Mitzrayim, the redemption, the creation of the nation. We're looking at that in our own lifetime, in real time. Number 6. There is a small comment in the section on Seul Amad, where the Baal Haggadah, where the Medrash tells us that one of the difficult things that we experienced in Egypt, one of the aspects of suffering that we had to endure, the pasuk says, "Vayareu osanu amitzim, vayyanunu, vayitnu aleinu avoda kasha." They gave us all of these sufferings, and we cried out. And what did Hashem hear? "Vayishma Hashem es kolenu, our voice, vayaris anyenu ve'esam aleinu ve'eslachatzenu." He saw our anyenu, our suffering, our affliction. Says the Medrash, "Zu precious derech eretz." This is the disruption of family life. So this is an important point to come back to for the Seder, and that is the role of family in the Jewish tradition. So for those who are married, so the basic component of this Haggadah, of this piece of the Haggadah, is Precious Derech Eretz. It is the unit, the family unit of a husband and a wife. And how significant that is. And that needs to be an area of focus and investment. And if we're preparing for Pesach, one of the things we should prepare should be involving, for those of us who are married, how to prepare in the context of a marriage. What are the things that my spouse is going to need as this Yontif takes shape? And what can I do to support that person? And it's going to differ from couple to couple and circumstance to circumstance. But thinking about it in advance, it's enough that the Rebbe Shlomo paid attention to that. So I would think we should give that a few moments of thought too. But that family unit is expanded, of course, in the Haggadah in general, the V'higadata Labincha, of the connecting to our children. The idea that this is initially a Korban Pesach for a mishpacha, a family. And if it's not a nuclear family, im yim'at habayis mios misev lokachu u'shcheino. So invite your neighbors. They become your extended family. You know, when we moved to Chicago, our closest family, I think Cleveland's about 350 miles away. So the extended friends, the shcheinim, they became our mishpacha, hakarvo beso. And that's very important on multiple levels. Of course, it's important because, especially when it comes to parents and children, it creates masora, the connection to previous generation. It creates a nurturing, safe environment. It gives us opportunities for role models, but it also creates self-definition. And some of us have mentioned it before, but I want to come back to it because I think it's really so important. And again, I apologize for the overly personal references, but I hope that you will be able to take these and utilize them in your own Seder, and it's just not just kind of my thinking about my own life. But last year in the Seder, I tried something different with my kids because the Pelkovitzes were there, Lahavdu Ben Chaim L'Chaim, Bobby Shirley, and now Rabbi Pelkovitz, Zichron Levracha. I told the kids during the Seder, you know, we have these a lot of incentives in our Seder. I already put in my order to Oriental Trading, my box of junk, every dumb ridiculously outrageous tchotchke is already ordered. It's going to be awesome. It always is. The more ridiculous, the more fun. So part of the, we have tickets, raffle tickets, and if anybody wants any suggestions for tchotchkeluch, we have them. I have them. I could send them around. So one of the things that we do is raffle tickets and then these Seder shekels that are printed with pictures on them. So one of the Seder shekels that I gave out last year was for the kids to go and ask Bubba and Saba questions at the Seder. Where did your parents live? Where did you meet each other? Where did you go to school? Because that's a part of Higadata Labincha. There is this amazing research that I shared once before. I'm happy to email it out again. There's a guy by the name of Marshall Duke, who is the Charles Howard Candler Professor of Psychology at Emory. And this became really big. I saw it because it appeared in the New York Times in an article called The Ties That Bind, that Bind Us, that they did a longitudinal study about kids who could answer 20 do you know questions about their family and what that meant for their future economic, social, and psychological, emotional well-being. And they had what's called the Do You Know Scale. And it showed that kids who could answer the questions on the Do You Know Scale ultimately led better lives because of that self-identity, because of that story that they knew how to tell. Isn't that what we're doing at the Seder? Isn't that the Mishpacha? And isn't that what the Egyptians were destroying with the family? So people were so curious about this that they actually published it online. So I downloaded it. Some of the questions are, do you know where your mother grew up? Do you know where some of your grandparents grew up? Do you know where your parents were married? Do you know what went on before you were born? Do you know some of the lessons that your parents learned for good from good or bad experiences? We need to tell these stories at the Seder so that our children can continue to tell those stories. My grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, whose wife just passed away, my grandmother. So he came to this country as a poor immigrant. He never had a chance to go to yeshiva because he was busy working to support the seven members of their family. His father was a rav. And my children know because I've told them so many times. Because when I was 12 years old, a few weeks before my bar mitzvah, my grandfather had a debilitating stroke. My grandparents couldn't come to my bar mitzvah, so my grandmother had to FedEx the meatballs. It was... My grandmother was unbelievable balabasta, I'm telling you. So she FedExed the meatballs. And after that, I used to go to visit with them. And I would sit with my grandfather and I would help him get dressed in the morning and get dressed at night because he had such a difficult, you know, time. So he wore like a nightshirt, a nightgown. I used to help him get into bed. And then when he was in bed, he would lie there and I would ask him to tell me about what it was like. So he would describe to me, and I told this to my kids millions of times, so somehow on Friday night, my 8-year-old mentioned it at the table, that when he came to America, he got a job, and then on Friday he got fired. And then he got a job, and then he got fired. And then he got a job, and he got fired, until he got a job sweeping floors and stocking shelves to support an entire family for $7 a week, because that was the only job that he could find as a Russian immigrant kid whose father was a rabbi, to get a job that would allow him to observe Shabbos. And that is the story that I'm going to tell to my children, and please God, if I'm fortunate, to every future generation. So that on Friday night, when something comes up at the table, my son, who's 8 years old, said, well, that's not a big deal. Well, you just get fired on Friday, like Grandpa. Something about observing Shabbos. Those are also the stories we have to tell at the Seder. Don't just be limited to what it says in your Haggadah. Because the stories of the Higadata Labincha, every person in this room has those stories. Those kinds of stories. Where did we come from? Do our kids know whether our families are Sephardic or Ashkenazic? And do they know whether we're from France or from Belarus? They need to know these questions. They need to know that's what our Masorah is. And the Seder is a great opportunity to do that. So think of ways in advance that you could give your kids or the people at your Seder or the people who don't know anything about a Seder to give them that intergenerational connection. Maybe it's a trivia game. Maybe it's questions about people who are no longer living, who are no longer at the Seder, who we want to get them to know. Maybe it's a picture book. Thinking creatively about those questions, about the Do You Know scale. The last question, and we'll end this section with this. It's a great question. Do you know about a relative whose face, quote-unquote, froze in a grumpy, whose face froze in a grumpy position because he or she did not smile enough? I'm not going to answer that question. Let's go on to number 7. Dayenu. Dayenu. So many commentaries ask the very famous and obvious question, and we'll give the same answer that we've given before, but it's important to review this answer because it gets to the same yisod, such an important principle called gratitude. And I was joking with Rabbi Pelkovitz because his son, Dr. David Pelkovitz, was sitting in the room, and I joked with him that I was going to talk about gratitude tonight because before they published their recent book together on positive psychology, Dr. Pelkovitz has sent me an advanced copy of Chapter 5 on gratitude because I needed it for a shiur. So I said, don't worry, I'm talking about gratitude. So it says, Dayenu would have been enough. No, it wouldn't. That's the truth. It would not have. It would not have been enough to leave Egypt and stand there at the side of a mountain and just say, that's the end of the Jewish story. Obviously, that wouldn't have been enough. And it wouldn't have been enough to get out of Egypt and not cross the sea. Obviously, that wouldn't have been enough. So what's the pshat? So many svarim say the same yesod. And that is that it's not enough, would have been enough to tell the story. It wouldn't have been enough for our destiny, but it would have been enough to say thank you. We got to say thank you. We got to express gratitude for every step in the journey. Even if that's not it. If someone does something for us, that may involve multiple components. Well, each of those components is something that person is doing for us. We should thank them for that. And we should be indebted to them for that. The exercise of gratitude is something we could do with the Seder. Dayenu is not just about what the Ribbono Shel Olam did for us 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago. Dayenu, what did the Ribbono Shel Olam do for us 75 years ago if we're lucky to have such a person at our Seder? What did the Ribbono Shel Olam do for us last week? So Dayenu reminds us that we are grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not just at the end when we finally make it, of Bona Lono Vespesa Bechira, we are grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We express gratitude. We have that Midah Vakaras HaTov for every stage. Number 8. Matzah. We say Matzah Al Shuma because why do we eat Matzah? Because the Ribbono Shel Olam rushed us out of Mitzrayim. Well, how do you know when something is no longer Matzah? Because in the times of the Gemara, they didn't have stopwatches and they didn't measure anything in 18 minutes. The times of the Mishnayos, they used to measure based on the physical makeup of the dough that was in front of them. They didn't have the same specialized matzah equipment that we have. They would look at it carefully. And the Gemara has a shear that has to do with cracks, fissures that form on the dough. It's called seor and siduk, like from the word sedek, cracks. If you start to see cracks in the dough, the Gemara has a discussion what level of chimutz that is, of leavening. But cracks is your indicator that you know that this dough is starting to rise, it's becoming chametz. That's the barometer. So Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, Shalita, the former chief rabbi of Israel, has in his Haggadah, this very nice Haggadah, it's about 10 years old, has in this Haggadah a beautiful idea. He says, now I can understand, al derech remez, why it is that you have to rid yourself of every smidgen of chametz in your life. Bal yiroi, bal yimotzi. It shouldn't be seen or shouldn't be found. Because when you're going to live a life of full Yiddishkeit, and especially if we're going to create a Jewish nation, you know what we need to get rid of before you start? Machlokas, cracks. When you start to see cracks, you know it's time to clean house. That's the indicator. Kol machmetzes lo sochelu. We can't tolerate any machlokas. It's not an easy thing to do, especially around Pesach time. Usually everybody's family is on top of everybody else. There's a lot of things going on. But the idea that we need to find ways to create unity and to drive disunity, to get rid of chametz, as chametz represents the cracks, the machlokas. Number 9. Why do we make a Pesach? Asher Pesach al bote avosenu. The Ribbono Shel Olam skipped over Pesach al ha-Pesach. He skipped over the doorways. So he skipped over the doorways. The Egyptians were killed and we were saved. So they quote an amazing, absolutely sensational vart from Rav Baruch of Mezhebuzh. You know, the Gemara says that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam looks to us and he says, look, the Medrash says, I want to have a relationship with you. Just do a little. Just make a little bit of effort. Take one half a step toward me and I'll do the rest. The image that the Medrash gives you is Pischuli Pesach Shalmachat. Open up an aperture, an opening that's the size of a needle. Va'ani Eftach Lechem. I'll open an opening that's the size of a corridor. Pesach Shal Ulam. That's what it says. God asks us, open an opening like a needle, the eye of a needle, and he says, don't worry, I'll do the rest. Says Rav Baruch of Mezhebuzh, you know what happened on the night of the Pesach? Hashem Yisbarach was Pesach al ha-Pesach with a tuf. He skipped over the Pesach, the opening. He said to us on the night of the Seder, you know what, guys, Kindelach, my beautiful Jewish people, on this night you don't even have to open the eye of a needle. I'll do it all. I want you to know, on one night a year, there is unconditional love. We can come close to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, even without the Petach Shel Machat. Even if we don't do anything, we had nothing to show for ourselves. As the Haggadah says, he quotes the Pasuk, Va'at Eirum Ve'eria. We were bereft, wholly bereft of mitzvahs. And yet, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam loved us. So Pesach represents the unconditional love that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam has for us. And that's how we start our relationship. And that's going to conclude the Seder for many people with the singing of Shir HaShirim. It's the love story between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And when there's such a strong love, people are willing to forego. When the love is that strong, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam says, I was asking you for 2%, but you know what? Even the 2% you don't need. I'll take you, I'll confinish Sharm, I'll carry you the whole way. I'll do it all. Because on this night, it's unconditional love. And isn't that an amazing lesson to make sure that we share at the Seder? And finally, we should end the Seder with a good dose of hope. And where does that come from? So there is an interesting smack. The Sefer Mitzvahs Katan, one of the Balei HaTosfos, the Tosfos living in the 13th century, who wonders, is there a commandment to believe in Mashiach? You know, it's very important, Ani Mamin, that we need to believe, and not just believe, we need to anticipate Mashiach, the redemption, the future redemption, the ultimate redemption. Says the Smak, yes, there is. So, where is it? Where do you see? Open up the Chumash, look in the 613. Where is there a mitzvah to anticipate the redemption? He says it's part of the mitzvah of Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeicha Me'eretz Mitzrayim. When we say that God took us out of Egypt, that's only the first half. We're saying God took us out of Egypt, and we believe and we anticipate that He's going to take us out again. So the story of the Seder, the story of God taking us out of Egypt, is not just retrospective. It's also prospective to say that just like God took us out on the night of Pesach from Mitzrayim, so too we anticipate that God is going to take us out of our current Mitzrayim. And that's why we conclude, and this already dates back many, many centuries, to conclude, L'shana haba, B'Yerushalayim habnuya. Because we want to end the Seder with a measure of hope. And it's not just kind of a, you know, a hope of a fairy tale. It's a hope that's grounded in the story that we just read. We just told the story of the Exodus, and therefore we have hope. Because the Smak says, just like God took us out then, He's going to redeem us again soon. And our hope and our prayer, there's plenty of time for God to send the Mashiach now before I have to clean my cars for Pesach. We'll solve everybody so many headaches. Kimeitzeis chamer, it's Mitzrayim, and renu nuflos. Our hope is benisa nigalu, benisa nasidin ligoil, that we should all merit the Geula Shleima very soon, and if not, wishing everybody a Chag Kasher V'Sameach. Thank you all for joining.